Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addisk, and James Corbett will be joining you for the second and third segments of the program today, and that is when it is Thursday, April 14th, 2016. I got that right. Yes, I know what day and month and year it is. It's Thursday, April 14th, 2016. It was a crazy day here at Discount Gold and Silver. And, you know, I've been running those specials on the Mint State 61 $20 gold pieces, and they can't be found. They've disappeared. And it was an incredible buy at those prices. And again, it just goes to show you how very little those coins, how little supply there are of those coins. So, hey, we still have specials, but they're beginning at Mint State 62 $20 gold pieces. So we are no longer selling Mint State 61 $20 Liberty gold pieces. So, again, very limited supply. Yes, we had a lot of pressure on gold today. We have gold down 1810 today, 1810, but that didn't stop the $20 gold pieces from going up a little bit. You have 1810 on gold to the downside at 1225. Silver's down 9 cents at 1622. Platinum is down 10 at 994. Palladium is up 15 at 563. And I did forget earlier in the week when I thought, well, of course, the week is not over yet, but we do have the IMF meeting here in Washington. And, you know, whenever there's the meetings, the Bilderbergers, whenever the elites have their meetings, you have upside in the stock market and downside in the gold and silver market. So I, you know, probably 95% of the time. So you'll have pressure on precious metals, and the paper markets do fine. And that's exactly what they did today. So we'll wait to see what tomorrow brings us. USDX today was up 94.95, up 0.14. And of course, earlier in the week, we were into the 93.99 area. So it's almost up a full point on the USDX. Crude oil was down a few cents, 36 to be exact, 41.40. And as I mentioned, the paper markets are all up significantly. And you have the Dow Well, they were up significantly earlier in the week. Today, they're only up 18 points at 17,926. The NASDAQ was basically unchanged at 49.45, and the S&P basically unchanged at 2,082. The 10-year yield bumped up a little bit, 0.02 at 1.78%, and Euro 1.13. European and Asian markets fairly unchanged, although Japan was up significantly, a little over 3%. So, yes, it's an exciting day, you know, when we give recommendations and we have sales, and I'm telling you the value there was in the Mid-State 61s to have them totally disappear. It was quite exciting to see that happen. So you, everyone got some great deals on those Mint State 61 $20 Liberty. So, but we do have 62, 63. So your next stepped up tomorrow. We will have, because of this happening so quickly, we're going to have David Krieger, one of my suppliers, join us on tomorrow's program. So make sure you tune in tomorrow. Gold sales surged in Japan through the month of March, and of course this was after the country moved to set negative interest rates, and all their people are scurrying for a shelter. And again, it's another sign that global central bank policy of keeping borrowing costs lower below zero is, you know, is creating a demand for gold and silver. Their bar sales climbed. This is gold bar, not the liquor bar, not the liquid. Not the booze bar, but gold bar sales climbed by 35% in the first 3 months from a year earlier. Consumer demand in Japan almost doubled to 32.8 metric tons in 2015. And, of course, these are all estimates according to the Gold Council. And we will have James Corbett talk about this next week if they haven't touched on it today. We know about, you have 24 countries have dropped policy rates below zero. So it's, you have the Bank of Japan, you have the European Central Bank, you have Denmark, Sweden, Switzerland, who have also had set sub-zero rates. And again, folks, this isn't helping anything. You have the Europeans, they're buying gold as a haven because of negative rates. Over the long run, negative interest rate policies may result in structurally higher demand for gold, not just investors, but also from central banks. And of course, this is from the Andrea Lang from the Austrian Mint. So gold's been doing extremely well. In the first 3 months of the year, gold advanced at 16% in 3 months, and the first through March. This is the best quarter in three decades. Can they say that about anything else? So, you know, when you hear these predictions of, you know, gold is going to go to 700, and we're going to touch on that. And maybe I'll go, I was going to touch on that going out of the segment. I wanted to touch about the defaults on the high-yield bonds. They're topping $14 billion in April, the largest monthly volume in 2 years. This is according to Fitch Ratings. The month isn't even half over yet. And I don't know, when we're dealing in trillions and trillions of dollars of debt, maybe $14 billion of defaults in the first 14 days of April, maybe that's just peanuts. But you have to look at what has happened, and it is the trend that this is going to continue. It's telling you, folks, there's problems out there. There's people that are losing billions of dollars. The dollar value of defaults is the most since April of 2014, when you had energy future holdings turn into the one of the largest bankruptcies in the United States. This month's default rate for coal companies, you know, we often reference our discussions mainly to the oil industry, to the energy industry, with oil in mind. But this also includes coal. We know what Obama has done to the coal industry, shutting down coal mines one after another. That company default rate is expected to come close to 70%. While the oil and gas exploration and production sector is anticipated to reach about 20%. 3%. Well, we did talk about that before we go on, about gold 700. And let's get to that. I had an interesting article. Maybe we can talk about this tomorrow, about the New Balance and the TPP agreement. And don't buy any New Balance shoes, all right? You know, I'm looking at the clock, and I bet we do have some time to discuss this. The Boston Globe reporting that the U.S.-based shoe manufacturer New Balance, they came out hard against the TPP trade deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. And but recently, the company has gone a little quiet on that trade deal. Now we found out. New Balance officials say one reason is that they were told the Department of Defense would give them serious consideration for a contract to outfit recruits with the athletic shoes if mum was the word on the TPP. If they didn't come out and say anything negative, they just kept their mouth shut. The government officials would perhaps reward them with a contract to outfit recruits with athletic shoes, but no order has been placed. New Balance official says the Pentagon is intentionally delaying any purchase. So the New Balance is reviving its fight against the trade deal, which would in part gradually phase out tariffs on shoes made in Vietnam. And a loss of the, we know what happens when there's a loss of these tariffs, would make imports cheaper and it would jeopardize its factory jobs in New England. Tariffs on shoes are steep. And New Balance is one of a handful of shoe companies that still manufacture shoes in the United States. Although, 75% of the shoes are made abroad. So it's not like 100% of the shoes are made here in the States. You know, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt, you know, okay. But still, they're here and they were at least providing jobs here in this area of Massachusetts. The company's leaders appear to disagree that the now broken deal was underhanded. There was no quid pro quo deal. We wanted to compete for a big piece of business that we are very confident we could win. So they kept their mouth shut about the TPP. VP of Public Affairs for the company tells the Globe that they swallowed the poison pill that is TPP so we could have a chance to bid on these contracts. We were assured this would be a top-down approach as the Department of Defense if we agreed to either support or remain neutral. But it doesn't look like they're going to get the deal as long as Obama is president. Well, you know, I really don't feel sorry for these guys. You know, again, as I mentioned, only 25% of what they do is here in the States. But they were willing to sell out every other U.S. manufacturer just so they could get a deal. They kept their mouth shut so they could get the deal. And they threw all the other manufacturers under the bus. So this is why I would not buy. I would boycott, personally me, whether you do or not, I'm not going to tell you to do that. But personally me, I would boycott New Balance, even though they're 25% of their U.S.-made shoes are here in the States. So anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting. And now we're going to get back to gold. We're going to get back to $700 gold. An email this morning says, "Hi, Melody. Dent is really sounding the warning bells on gold going into the toilets. What do you think?" And this is Harry Dent. And I'm sure you've all heard his interviews. I'm sure you all heard his prediction of gold going to 700. I don't know if any of you have ever taken any of his investment advice, but I really don't think Harry Dent knows what he is talking about, or he does. There is far greater upside risk to gold than a downside risk. There's more possibilities of going higher for gold than down to 700. Greenspan, in a recent interview, I believe it was just today, he only confirms that we've been telling you for years the stimulus is not working. Markets are up as billions, if not trillions, are coming in from China, buying up assets, real estate, and so forth. Corporations are borrowing money to support their share prices. The fundamentals for the stock market, the paper markets, the paper asset markets, is based on corruption and manipulation. Paper assets carry more downside risk than up at these levels. So anyway, on with Harry Dent. I did a little investigation. I found an article where the writer took the time to review every prediction Dent ever made. This article will be in our newsletter on Monday. And this was done, you know, several years ago. This information was provided by AVA Investment Analytics. So there are a few things that I'm going to point out. And it's true, the guy who wrote this or provided this information, it sounds like he does have it in for Dent for one reason or another. But on the other hand, he went through timeline from the very first book Harry Dent wrote, and with his predictions, why his predictions were wrong, how Harry Dent came to these predictions, what he was viewing, and it really shows the motive behind all the strange predictions that was made throughout the years. And, you know, Harry Dent was a big hedge fund guy. Wall Street loved him. And because of all these weird and wild predictions, and earlier in the year 2000s and through the, you know, up until 2010 and so forth, they no longer, you know, they kind of shoved him out the door. They didn't want to have the connection with him any longer. This is what I gather from reading this information from the AVA Investment Analytics. So what did Harry Dent do? He found another niche. He found a niche, another venue. And there's a lot of Wall Streeters in this category. And they turned not to the Wall Street people, but they turn to the alternative media. These people would never be caught dead on shortwave radio. They weren't on shortwave radio in the 90s with their predictions. Some of these silver gurus that are telling you that, you know, with all these shortages and everything, where were they in the 1990s when silver was, you know, $2? You could have purchased a ton of silver at $2. These were the same guys that were in Wall Street telling you not to buy it. But then all of a sudden they have this revelation, you know, after the great quote on recession, they have this great revelation. And now all of a sudden, you know, they're out of Wall Street and in a new venue, hawking silver and gold. No, I'm sorry, folks, you know, maybe I am different because it really does come from my heart. I really do believe in gold and silver. I really do believe there isn't anything else. Anything else is pretty much speculation and a gamble. There's reports from Pastor Butch Paul and his interviews and so forth and some other places. We're going to have a tough week next week, I believe, because Russia is meeting with the Saudis on the 17th, with some OPEC members. I don't know if it's the full OPEC, all the members, but some of them anyway, about capping production for oil. To me, I see that as a reflection on the petrodollar. So yeah, that's the 17th. Anything could happen after that. So that means the petro, I don't know if it will have an impact on the petro, but I certainly do see a pretty good indication that all is not well. We have this big meeting this weekend. So, yeah, there's a lot of things coming down the pike. And with the election and Donald Trump, yeah, there's a lot of things going on. So what he talks about is how, you know, Dent's only goal is to herd the sheep. He pitches his approach is simple. He has a simple approach to predicting complex trends. And it's a common tactic that is used by snake oil salesmen because they want to appeal to the largest number of prospects. So you can find the rest of this in our newsletter. Go to our website, dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Sign up for the weekly newsletter. It comes out Monday. And again, folks, you're looking to add some $20 gold pieces to your portfolio. Don't listen to these guys who say it's not the coin you should buy because they're doing you wrong. The key to buying these $20 gold pieces is buying it at my price and getting the right one that is suitable for you to and you need to diversify. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Right after the breaks, you will be joined by Al and Mr. Corbin.
Heart condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
I'm Alfred Adusk, and this is Financial Survival. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report. James is generally here on Wednesday night when we interview him, and for Thursday when the program is rebroadcast during the daytime show. Part of the reason we do that, of course, is because it's breakfast time for James in Japan, and it's bedtime for me here in Texas, and we have to kind of make a little accommodation in order so we can be on the same clock. So, James, how's your breakfast?
Actually, we're heading on towards lunchtime. It's coming up towards noon, so I might get a little hungry during the interview.
Might be. Well, it may be daylight. Do we have daylight savings time in Japan? Does that explain
my confusion?
Don't. Well, that's probably why I'm confused about this. We've seen a report from Reuters. We touched on this last week. IMF warns Brexit could deal blow to global economy. According to the International Monetary Fund, Britain could deal a damaging blow to the fragile global economy if it votes to leave the European Union at its June 23rd referendum. First, what are the chances that England will, in fact, move out of the European Union, distance itself from the European Union on June 23rd? What are the chances that's going to happen? If it does happen, will the European Union be badly damaged? Will it really be badly damaged, or will it be just inconvenienced? And finally, will other nations follow Britain's example?
A three-part question. I think there was a lot embedded in there. All right, let's pick it apart. Will it, as far as what the IMF is saying, will it affect the global economy? I think that's more of the scaremongering and hype that we've seen, that we saw, for example, when Scotland was talking about exiting from the United Kingdom or detaching itself from Great Britain. I think that was a lot of hype and scaremongering and fear that was used to try to swing the vote towards the globalist side. You've got to be in the EU in order to be able to do anything productively in the economy. I think that's a load of nonsense. And I'm pretty sure the global economy will find a way to you know, power through if Britain is no longer part of the EU, whatever that really means. I mean, it's not even part of the Eurozone. It's just part of the European Union. So I don't expect, I mean, there would obviously be things to work out in terms of how does this affect trade deals and borders and customs and all of that. But I'm sure there wouldn't be, an overnight grinding to a halt of all trade. So I think that's a lot of scaremongering. But, I mean, will it affect the EU, yes, certainly. It would have a dramatic effect, I think, because Britain, although not really a founding kind of central member, I think the EU is more built upon the, you know, French, Dutch, German, Northern European axis than it is the British outlier. But still, I mean, it's a pretty big nation, a pretty important economy, a pretty important nation diplomatically and politically, militarily. So I'm sure that it would have a pretty important effect, and it would have a psychological effect, I think, on the rest of the European Union. Would it cause other people? It would certainly embolden other people in other parts of the EU who are interested in getting out of the EU, and it would certainly be a very, very shining example for them about how to do that. So it would have some pretty big effects that way. I just think that the economic side of it is being overblown in order to try to shift people's opinion.
What about England itself? Is this simply a psychological reaction? The English people may not want to be part of the European Union, and so they're likely to vote themselves out on an emotional basis. Or will England actually be, if the European Union stands to lose, does England stand to gain if it walks out of the European Union?
Well, I think so. And maybe I'm biased because I think decentralization and getting away from centralized globalist bodies is for the benefit of humanity and everyone. But I think it is in the interests of the UK people to, at the very least, try to set their policy, economic and legislation and laws at least within the borders of their own country. I mean, why go to Brussels to decide what their trade policies and all of that should be. So I think it is to their benefit. And I think a lot of British people, a lot of Brits understand this. I mean, there's never been a great love for the European Union in England. It's just that a lot of people, you go along to get along. Certain business people, I'm sure, see it being in their business interests for Britain to be part of it. But I think the average person on the street has no great love for the European Union as some sort of institution. And certainly in recent years, UKIP, the UK Independence Party, has tapped into that and has really started to galvanize opinions to make it to the point where it's at least politically feasible to hold this type of referendum. And it's going to be at least close. I want to be optimistic that the British people really have the choice on their plate here. I am not so optimistic that this will result in an independence vote. But at any rate, I think it's the closest that we've been in decades for this to really materialize. I think there is something in the air right now, especially right now with the immigration crisis and all of that, adding to people's sense that there really is no great benefit, and there's a lot of drawbacks to being tied at the hip with all of these other countries.
Mm-hmm. I've got an article here from Zero Hedge, and the headline is, Europe is burning. Nigel Farage slams Merkel's migration maelstrom. All right. A little purple prose there, maybe. From ISIS marches in Germany to refugees doing normal manly things to women in Sweden, UKIP, the United Kingdom Independent Party, leader Nigel Farage confronts Angela Merkel and her peers in the European Parliament over the dreadfully misguided immigration policies. According to Nigel Farage, Europe is burning. And just like the central bankers of the world, their solution is insanely simple-minded. Europe isn't working, so we must have more Europe. The only hope he has in the British referendum, showing there's a British referendum showing the rest of the world it's possible to take back control of its own borders. First off, what's your take on Nigel Farage? I'll take these questions one at a time rather than giving you a list of them.
Well, in terms of anti-European voices in the EU Parliament, I don't think I've seen anyone who is more stringently and cogently and consistently articulating the anti-globalist, anti-EU perspective. So he's always quite entertaining when he talks on those things. And I think generally he is correct. Europe is burning, both in the sense of all of the social and chaos and cultural chaos that's happening with the immigration and all of that, but also economically. Of course, we've seen, you know, banking destabilization in Italy coming back in the last couple of months. And of course, Greece continues to be a festering wound in the European economy. So in a lot of senses, he's quite correct on that. In terms of the UKIP generally, I would say I'm not politically excited and aligned with them, because I think that on a lot of other issues, they just tend to be hardline conservatives in the negative sense, in terms of we need more, you know, more of a police state at home, which, of course, I'm not in favor of. But in terms of the EU policies, I think anti-EU ideas, he articulates them quite well.
Do you think the Muslims can be assimilated into a non-Muslim culture like Europe? Can they be assimilated, or is this, you know, well, you get the question. You understand what I'm
saying. Yeah, of course I do. It really is a question that has a history to it. It doesn't come in a vacuum. And we've seen this articulated in the last couple of decades by people like Samuel P. Huntington, who came out with the Clash of Civilizations. And that, I think, is the central organizing principle that global geopolitics is working on in this era, in the same way that the Cold War was the central central principle that global geopolitics was working on, you know, pre-Soviet collapse. And I think that's been consciously planned, and we've seen the steer towards that. So we have to understand this question in the context of, at the very least, the last century of manipulation and stacking of the deck, and the fostering of radical Muslim ideologies by the West and the Western intelligence agencies for the purposes of keeping nationalist movements in check in various parts of the world. That was a very big part of the mid-20th century strategy, trying to keep pan-Arab nationalists like Nasser in Egypt down by creating and fomenting the Muslim Brotherhood and other organizations like that, or, of course, propping up the Saudi royal family with their radical, crazy Wahhabi Islam as a way of being a sort of controllable element within the Middle East that would be pliable to U.S. interests. So we have to understand that question in the context of this all being fomented for decades and decades and decades, at the very least. Again, going back at least a century when you look at the British occupation of Palestine and others, so other places of that chessboard. So once we understand that context, it is a good question. I mean, at this point, with those types of radical ideologies having been fostered and fomented and really propagated, they have gotten to a point where they do have a traction with a lot of the public, for example, in the Middle East, in the Arab nations. And it does become a question, are these cultures compatible, and can they merge? Can they assimilate? How does this take place?
Can they even tolerate?
can they even tolerate? Yes. And I think obviously there are certain sectors and sections of Islam that which it clearly is not compatible, and they can't, you know, tolerate non-believers. But again, I think we have to understand this in the sense that this has been fostered and really inculcated. And what the question ultimately is, what do you do with that? I mean, once we realize there has been a concerted, coordinated effort that goes to even to the micromanagement level, I think people don't understand the level to which this works. For example, people may know that there's a deep tie between U.S. and Pakistani intelligence, so that the ISI has often been seen as an adjunct of the CIA. But people don't know the extent to which, for example, the Pakistani ISI and the Pakistani government, which has fostered the Taliban, really, by creating all of these radical madrasas in Afghanistan and Pakistan that creates these fervent, you know, Muslims that want to kill. They use teaching materials that, for example, teach children how to read or how to count by counting bombs, counting guns, counting things like this, like things that obviously are inculcating a sort of militaristic attitude. And those textbooks are actually being paid for by funds from USAID. When you start looking at the way that entire societies have been inculcated with this, it really does change the emphasis of where is the root of this problem. And we do see time and time again in a lot of these countries where these types of terrorist attacks that are going on actually generally are turned towards against the Arab countries themselves. I mean, we've seen, for example, Iraq torn apart with violence, obviously, Afghanistan torn apart with violence, Syria torn apart with violence. Generally, this is aimed internally more so than it is externally. And so we see local populations often very much against these types of radical Islamic groups. But then they gain popularity when the Americans and whoever else, NATO, comes in and starts bombing their population to shreds because, hey, these guys are against them. So I think there's a much more complicated geopolitical strategy going on here that we have to take into account the full context to understand the question. The short answer is there certainly are Muslim fundamentalist crazy radicals who will not tolerate other cultures. But I think the deeper question is, well, how is that being inculcated and what can we do to stop that?
Well, what can we do to stop it? Can we stop it? I mean, some of these people, even if this culture has been artificially created, the radicals, it's been around long enough now where it has a life of its own. It has a history of its own. It's not something new where somebody walks in the door and says, hi, I'll give you some money if you act like a radical. Now we've got your dad was a radical and your grandfather was a radical and maybe your grandfather was a radical, and where are you? You're going to be radical too. This culture has enough history now where it won't be easily given up. When I look at this, I'm reminded classic definition of a race, of a nation is one race of people speaking one language within fixed borders. There might be a little bit more to it, but the idea is a nation historically was fairly homogenous. When we invite immigrants from a culture that we have reason to believe is not going to assimilate, is this an attempt to create so much internal abuse, destabilization within the country that the country is no longer a viable threat to, say, the New World Order? I mean, if the United States gets enough immigration, if they have enough immigration and the culture is radically changed, we can fight with the guy across the street. We don't have time to fight with somebody in Brussels.
Right, yes. Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying, and I agree with that, because I think that this is about balkanization. And that's kind of a strange thing when we're looking at the idea of globalization. Clearly, they just want people getting more and more used to regional and then sort of global culture or whatever. I think it works in an opposite way. They want to atomize people as much as possible so that they're fighting each other as much as possible, exactly as you say, so that they can't effectively fight these kind of overarching institutions, which really are, you know, puppeteering this and controlling and, you know, entire continents' economic and military policies at this point, like in Europe. So I think you're right. I mean, there's kind of a way in which the balkanization creates the possibility for further globalization. And it's, although they seem like opposite forces, I think they work hand in hand.
Yeah, and you have to wonder, what are people's motives? For example, what motivated Germany's Angela Merkel to encourage immigration of Middle East refugees? What did she really believe? What really moved her? Is she doing something because she thought this is good for business? We're going to get cheap labor. Hooray, we're going to get cheap labor and Germany can make more money. Or did she understand this is going to cause trouble that will essentially fracture at least Germany and ultimately Europe also into, it'll balkanize them just as you're describing. What motivated Angela Merkel?
Well, I can't read Merkel's mind, so I don't know what motivated her. But I do know that at this point, certainly by now, I don't think any politician in Europe can claim that they don't understand the effects that these policies are having or the types of cultural tensions that are coming to the fore now. So at this point, I mean, further pushing towards this agenda is clearly being done with the full knowledge and intention that it will cause further strife and further balkanization. As I say, more people getting atomized, getting into their little groups and fighting with each other rather than fighting against the bigger forces out there.
Exactly. Let's take a break for some commercials. We'll be back with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, Corbett, report.com. Please stay tuned.
Financial obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at the 3Ws dot thepowerherbs.com.
Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
I'm Alfred Addis. Excuse me. Here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, Corbett, report.com, talking about various geopolitical issues or anecdotes, or here's one that is not even perhaps an anecdote or an issue. It's maybe just a conspiracy theory of my own creation. Here's a headline from Bloomberg. Saudi Arabia plans $2 trillion mega fund for post-oil era. Saudi Arabia is getting ready for the twilight of the era of the oil age by creating the world's largest sovereign wealth fund for the kingdom's most prized assets. What they're going to do, $2 trillion public investment fund to help wean Saudi Arabia off oil. Saudis will sell shares in Aramco's parent company and transform the oil giant into an industrial conglomerate. Right. However, the International Monetary Fund, a study in 2014, noted that there were many examples of failure by countries trying to reduce reliance on energy production and few successes. The reason that strikes me as interesting is it indicates that Saudi Arabia is trying to implement a strategy that's been tried in the past and usually failed. So I'm wondering, why are the Saudis trying a strategy known to usually fail? Do they think this time it's different and they can pull it off?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's that so much as I don't think they have a choice. And It's not just to do with the commodity route, the oil route that we've seen over the last year and a half, 2 years of the falling oil prices. I think that's kind of the kick in the butt that got them towards this and thinking about this. But I think that they see that the writing is on the wall, especially after the Paris climate conference last December. And now, of course, everyone is trying to reorient now that we're moving towards the post-carbon future, like it or not, hook or by crook, the $90 trillion of energy investments that are going to be made over the next couple of decades to try to get people off of oil in various harebrained schemes that probably won't work when we're talking about wind energy or things of that nature. But anyway, that's where the money is moving. That's where the markets are moving. And I think that Saudi Arabia recognizes that whether it's, you know, a decade from now or 2 decades from now or 3 decades from now, at a certain point, oil is not going to be the steady source of revenue that it is for them right now. And that's a big concern for the Saudi royal family, which essentially exists by bribing its population. Saudi Arabia, of course, doesn't have income tax. It has very generous social programs, which are the basis for its ability to maintain control over the country. And when that gravy train comes to an end, I don't think the royal family is under any delusions about how much the public would love and respect them, even if they weren't putting that bread and butter on the table. So I think this is more of a CYA kind of maneuver. They have to do this, and this is the only strategy that they have on available to them. And it's not a terrible strategy. It's something that they can do. Start transferring the ownership away and start investing the money into other things and try to diversify. It's really the best option they have on the table, I think.
Do you think that this option is really being advanced with the idea of providing some benefit to the nation of Saudi Arabia? Or could it be another one of the kicks in the pants, as they're considering the possibility of being overthrown in a political revolution? I'm wondering, how do they get their money and their wealth out of Saudi Arabia?
Yeah.
And what I'm wondering about, are they saying, oh, we're going to set up a $2 trillion fund here to take care of all you little people? And are they really just figuring out a way how to move their money offshore and get rid of Aramco and perhaps protect their fortune by putting it into European banks or wherever? Does that seem plausible, or is that too much of a conspiracy?
I'm sure that is part of this. Absolutely, they're looking how do you liquefy and get that money out of there. So yeah, I'm sure that there's a lot of that goes on, and it has been going on. It is going on. We know actually a little bit about that because we know from the Panama Papers, for example. There was one of the documents in there was about the king of Saudi Arabia who apparently used a shell company purchased through this Mossack Fonseca law firm to purchase some real estate in London, for example. Again, on the big scheme of things, not exactly the most, you know, world-shaking corruption, but I think at least a peek into what the Saudi royal family is doing with their money and how they're moving it out of the country. Again, I'm sure this process has been going on for a while and will accelerate with the liquefaction of Aramco and the creation of this $2 trillion slush fund.
I've got an article from the AFP from about 10 days ago. Greece wants International Monetary Fund explanations over WikiLeaks report. I mean, WikiLeaks, is there any such thing as secrecy in the internet age?
Yes, I think so, but only for the people who, you know, are the connected cronies who can afford it. I mean, even if nothing else, can you imagine WikiLeaks as a grand extortion operation? I mean, even if it is what it claims to be, I mean, it certainly has the goods on a lot of people. And it would be the perfect way to extort money out of governments or out of people that have that money to slush around and don't want certain secrets to come to light. So even if WikiLeaks is what it says it is, you know that there are other groups out there that are doing this type of thing for the monetary incentive. So again, if you can afford it, if you have the right connections, I'm sure there are ways to keep your secrets. But for the average guy, probably not.
Here's the article continues again. Greece wants IMF explanations over WikiLeaks report. Greece on Saturday demanded explanations from the International Monetary Fund after WikiLeaks said the lender sought a crisis event to push the indebted nation, that's Greece, into concluding talks over its reforms. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras said he would call, would write to International Monetary Fund Chief Christine Lagarde and reach out to European leaders after WikiLeaks published what it said was a transcript of a teleconference in which IMF officials complained that Athens only moves decisively when faced with the peril of default. An event was therefore needed to drive the threat of default and get the Greeks to act. The nature of such event was not specified. The Greek government reacted strongly to the report, saying it wanted the IMF to clarify its position. The IMF did not comment on leaks. It said it didn't comment on leaks or supposed reports of internal discussions. My question in all of this is, what sort of event do you suppose members of the IMF might be talking about? They said, we need an event to get to make the Greeks toe the line. Were they talking about something like Pearl Harbor or the Gulf of Tonkin or maybe 9/11? Is that the kind of event they're talking about, or what do you think?
It certainly could be something along those lines, but it certainly could be an economic event. I mean, maybe they were looking for some sort of economic 9/11. But yes, I mean, again, this shouldn't be surprising to our regular listeners. We've talked about it a lot of times. I mean, who benefits in the wake of any type of scare, security or economic? It is the people who come along that want to centralize more power for themselves. So it shouldn't be surprising at all to find that the IMF's internal deliberations are all about how we can basically force that sense of crisis in Greece in order to get them to come to the table.
What do you think motivates people to want the kind of power to be able to run a global economy? A one-world government. I mean, isn't this, don't you have to be really a little bit crazy? If you're in a position where you've got enough wealth, where you have enough wealth to be part of a conspiracy to establish one-world government, isn't that enough to go buy an island someplace and jet around the world or do whatever you want to do? Why take the aggravation of trying to manage the affairs of several billion people? You get my point here?
Oh, I certainly do. Yeah. No, I very much take your point, because you and I, and I think I imagine most of the people listening to this conversation, don't have a desire to rule or control other people or manipulate them or use them as pawns or see the world in that way. The average person just wants to, you know, okay, I'll do my 9 to 5 and then at the weekend, you know, have a bowling and beer party or something. You know, that's what the average person wants, because that's the way the average person interprets the world. For high functioning psychopaths, it really is about trying to control everything. It is about that sense of control. And if you can control the entire society, hey, right down to the individual level, hey, all the better. And at the most charitable, you could imagine that there are people who are involved in these types of activities who have the mindset that they truly believe that they can engineer a society that will be better for more people. And they believe as long as they're in charge and they get to control it, they can create the perfect society. There are people like that in that system. I think the ones at the very top probably just desire the control itself. But I see why the sort of meddling technocrats and people who have the technical know-how to bring this about probably do believe they are working in the best interests of society, like, say, a B.F. Skinner or someone like that, who did a lot of research into how individual humans can be controlled and shaped and their beliefs and opinions formed and how you can get people's behaviors regulated in certain ways. I'm sure he did believe that the ultimate goal of this was to create a perfect society where everyone's happy. But it's a nightmare society to you and me and most people who just want to be left alone.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Let's move to Brazil. Is the entire continent of South America deeply immersed in economic and political trouble, or is the problem mostly only with Brazil and maybe Venezuela? All of South America in trouble, or just Brazil and Venezuela?
Well, I mean, certainly at the moment it's centered on Brazil, and Venezuela is, of course, also there. Argentina not looking so good either, and their new president has just been implicated in this Panama Papers leak as well, so maybe some further political destabilization there. Bolivia still not performing particularly well. I think that there is a sort of malaise in South America generally, but it is certainly concentrated on Brazil right now. That's where the fireworks are happening. And there aren't a lot of bright spots on that. A decade ago, Brazil was soaring, and there was a lot of positivity and happiness and let the good times flow, largely on the back of an increasing trade relationship with China. There was definitely that that part of the calculus. But that's definitely disappeared, obviously, with the slowdown of China. And there doesn't seem to be anything on the horizon that's likely to take its place anytime soon. The only kind of good news that Brazil, economies like Brazil, is getting is that, well, there might actually be an impeachment and removal from office of Rousseff, which means the change in government could potentially bring a bit more business-friendly policies to the table. And on the back of that kind of, well, this could create a better thing in the long run, we've seen the real actually rallying in recent days. But, I mean, that's the type of, you know, smoke mirrors, hope and change nonsense that that Brazil's economy is resting on right now.
If there is a political meltdown in Brazil, will other South American countries be dragged down, or will most of them get by without more trouble than they already have?
Well, Brazil is obviously a central part of the South American economy. It's an extremely integral part of that. So, I mean, there can't be a huge destabilization shakeup in Brazil without it affecting its major trading partners there in Latin America. It is going to have an effect, and it's not a good effect. Obviously, it's an anchor. It's a drag down on the rest of the economy at a time when, as I say, I mean, Argentina, Venezuela, there isn't exactly a happy spot right now in South America that would be able to pick up the slack. So it's a downward pull for sure.
Is there a happy spot anywhere on the globe where we can sit back and say, well, you know, if I could move here, then I'd be everything will be all right. The rest of the world can go to heck. But if I could get to this one place, I'd be happy.
I wish that I could say that. Unfortunately, there is nothing that comes to mind at this point. I don't want to say it's all doom and gloom, but there are certainly potential weak points in every region of the globe right now. And all the weak points add up. They're cumulative, and they affect each other, and they influence and add to each other. So it does not create a very good system. I mean, I'm not trying to be scaremongering here, but obviously, this is a house of cards, right?
Yeah.
And once the winds start to blow, it doesn't matter if you're the strongest card in that house or if you're in the best position in the house. When the house collapses, you know, there's not a lot you can do about it. And again, I'm not saying it's going to be an overnight Mad Max collapse kind of thing, but I'm just saying that we're not built on a solid foundation of a stable, solid monetary supply and, you know, happy, productive economy. So I don't think that there's any place in the world that's looking positive at the moment. The only thing that I can think of is some of the lower rungs on the ladder in some of the nations, for example, in Central Asia or in Africa, where China has been investing its infrastructure, building money in the last decades, certainly. Those have a lot of room for growth. So relatively, they may be boosted a little, but it won't amount to much in terms of the overall economy of the world.
All right, James, I think we'll let it go at that point. No place to run to, which means you got to stand and fight where you are. We're out of time, folks. I want to thank all of you for listening, and I want to thank James Corbett from the Corbett Report for being on the program again. Always a pleasure, always interesting, always educational. We'll be back. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, good Lord bless you, me, Melody, James Corbett, Frank the producer. Bye-bye.
I work work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me.